Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you're talking to me, I hear everything, I see everything, I am all knowing.
This is Penn Sunday School, and to our listening ears, all angels sing and round us rings the music of the
spirit. Here we go!
Brother, sister, siblings, welcome to Penn Sunday School. My name is Reddy Rich, coming to you live from Show Creator Studios here in Las Vegas, Nevada. Today's guest, you know him, you love him, a man who needs no introduction. So, here he is, your host coming to you from Masterclass, Mr. Penn Jillette.
Preaching love. That's what I'm doing, Reddy Rich. I'm preaching the love on Penn Sunday School. And we are brought to you now by Masterclass, a lifelong learning at Masterclass. And we'll talk about more of this in the middle of the show. But right now, our listeners get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/Penn. Get 50% off right now at masterclass.com/Penn. Masterclass.com/Penn. He didn't do it. Kramer didn't do it once. You notice that?
I thought this was a private affair.
He didn't say Penn even once. Kramer's here, and Kramer's also staying at my house. So we figured, what the fuck? Bring him in here. Kramer is a musician, producer.
Can I prove it? I keep doing this. And is that coming through? Am I? Mm-hmm. I'm live. Okay.
Well, it's coming through your mic.
It's coming through my mic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want to play something?
There you go.
Kramer.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kramer is known to maybe, possibly, the listener, five people.
And if you subtract the three in this room, I'd like to count myself, that leaves two. My wife is probably listening. So, you know, this, I've never been on a podcast before. Is this and I've certainly never been on Penn Sunday School. Is this something, how should I look at this? Is this something that's a long time coming, or should we rethink this now before we get too far into it? The door is right there. I could be gone in a heartbeat.
You know, we've talked about so many things on Pendy Sunday School.
Yeah, Pendy.
Because we've done a million of these. Mm. And I just thought we could talk a little bit, you know, as our listeners are all too aware of, I listen to Andrew Hickey's 500 Songs Rock and Roll.
You talk about it a lot?
A lot.
Okay.
What I love about that is getting the stories of how people end up. Now, if you had to impress somebody, okay, instantly, what is the first credit you give? Galaxy 500? Butthole Surfers?
You know, when you say somebody,
it depends on who it is.
It really depends on who it is. If it's somebody who I know is not ever going to have heard of Galaxy 500 or Low or Half Japanese or mm-hmm. or White Zombie or all the other things, if I was looking at somebody who I knew was only going to know one thing that I've done, mm-hmm. it would be a Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon by Urge Overkill for the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Pulp.
That's the only thing I've done that probably everybody in the world outside of Kazakhstan has heard.
Yeah, yeah. That's someone my children's age.
Yeah.
You know, Pulp Fiction is still very much in their life.
Yeah.
So they're very aware of that.
That would be my calling card in a room full of, how should we call them?
Young people.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with saying young people.
No, that's just because we're old, what nerve we have.
Did you do that for Pulp Fiction, or was it already recorded?
No, I did. It's a wonderful story. Would you like to hear the whole thing?
Yes, I would like to hear the whole thing. It
takes about 67 seconds. Well, they were in my studio recording one side of an EP, which means three songs, but they only came into the studio with two songs. At the time, they had issues with... I'm okay to talk about this, right? Like, you don't get sued for calling people junkies or anything on this show. Are we all right?
I don't think I will. I think you might.
Okay, well, what the hell? Let's just... And we had done the two songs, and they didn't know what else to do, so we had to obviously choose a cover.
Now, did you work with them before? Or just
I had never worked with them before. I knew them, and I had played gigs with them before with on various double and triple bills and things like that.
And you were a gun for hire?
Yeah, I called them up and just bugged the shit out of them until they finally, can I say shit? Yeah. Okay, so they didn't know what to do for a third song, and I said, well, let's go look at my CD collection. And I had maybe six shelves of CDs. A to D was the first shelf, and as we approached the CD collection from the right, the first thing we hit was the D's, and they were right at about eye level. You get the idea, coming from the east to west, and we hit the D's, and I just looked, and the first thing I saw was Neil Diamond. And I said, you guys like Neil Diamond? Oh, we love Neil Diamond. So I pulled out a CD and looked, and one of the first songs on the CD, Greatest Hits, was Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. And I couldn't imagine anybody else having covered that, and I couldn't come up with that having happened before. So I said, let's do that song. We went back in the studio. They rehearsed it a little bit. They put down the drums and the guitar and the bass. And then they said, okay, we're done. We'll be back in 5 minutes to mix it. 5 minutes later, they didn't come back. 10 minutes later, they didn't come back. 15 minutes
having
later.
Having a little jazz walk?
A little bit of jazz walk in the waiting room. So I thought, okay, let me get to work here and take advantage of the situation. So I put down a 12-string guitar overdub, sitting at the mixing board, just pressing record, and had a microphone, very much like right here, just sitting in front of it. Then I put a tambourine on it. Then I put a toy piano on it. Mm-hmm. Then I thought, what the hell, let's do a baby grand piano. And then I went into the studio, into the waiting room, to see how they were doing. And they were on the floor, like...
doing very well.
They looked great.
Well, it depends on your point of view, right?
Yeah,
they were doing very well.
Yeah, they looked great. So I checked to make sure they were still breathing, and I went back into the studio, and I mixed the song and put it on a DAT. Remember DATs?
I do remember. I still think I have a DAT player somewhere.
Really? I'd like to borrow it, because mine stopped working 20 years ago. I mixed the song and got them upright. They looked at their watch, found that they were an hour away from needing to be at Maxwell's in Hoboken for a sound check. So they immediately started packing up their gear. They didn't even listen to the mix or anything. And, you know, I didn't really...
You haven't mentioned vocal, though. They did the vocal...
Yes, they did the vocals first. It was only there's only one vocal track. There's no backing vocals or anything like that. So they did that right away before they imbibed.
Took a vacation.
Yeah, before they imbibed.
And so as far as they were concerned, when Pulp Fiction came on, they said, hey, that's my voice. Who's playing that 12-string?
I think they heard it before that. But the funniest part of the story is that as they were leaving, I had almost forgotten to give them the DAT tape. So I ran out to the driveway where they were in the van and getting ready to go. And they were not well. You know, they were sickly at best. Blackie seemed to be on the verge of serious illness. And I handed the tape to Nash, who was at the steering wheel. And I said, if anybody ever hears this song we just did, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, it's going to be a fucking hit. And he looked at me and he looked at Blackie, and Blackie leaned out the passenger side window and vomited profusely all over my driveway. And then Nash turned to me and said, Kramer, we don't make hits. 1 year later, I was touring in Japan and I saw a poster. And in Japan, they put the music on a lot of the film posters. And right at the bottom, it said, featuring the hit single, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon by Urge Overkill, produced by Kramer. And I had no inkling of any of this. And and I had only just seen Reservoir Dogs. So I was very happy.
That's when you bought your mansion with the money you got from that?
The $500. Yes, I bought a $500 mansion. It's about this big.
$500? That's what you got?
Yeah, I got my day rate for the studio, and I didn't have a producer's fee or anything like that, and they were not generous enough to include me in their thoughts when it went worldwide viral, because it wasn't just a great song in a great movie. It was the song in the movie of that year, you know?
So did they make some jingle?
Oh, God, yes. Yes, that kept them in for 30 years. Can I say that?
Are you still waiting? Are you still waiting for them to send you a little check on that?
Am I still waiting? Wow. No, you know, I got a $500 fee, and I usually don't get a producer's royalty. I have mixed feelings about all that, you know?
Well, you know, that is interesting because, you know, Carol Kay, of the Wrecking Crew.
The great bass player.
Which doesn't really exist. The Wrecking Crew was named after that. Mm-hmm. But these sessions people in L.A., mm-hmm. you know, you'll sometimes hear her complaining that she came up with bass lines. The idea is if you are a sessions person, you're paid your sessions fee, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then you're supposed to be done.
Yeah.
So you made very clear that they paid you the money for the day, and that was the deal, and they walked away. And what they did may not have been generous, but it certainly wasn't unfair.
That is correct. And I usually tell bands on the way out the door, hey, if something happens with this song, feel free to throw me a check. But I don't put a piece of paper in front of them that says, hey, if something happens with this song, throw me a check, sign here.
What people have been generous?
Nobody. It's just the nature of the business, really. And for me, you know, it would be nice to be able to pay off my daughter's student loan. But I feel the reward is the work, and I feel really lucky that at 65 years old, I'm still doing this, and my phone still rings occasionally. I think I'm one of the luckiest people in the world, aside from the fact that I've just been sort of treading water financially for my entire adult life.
Well, how did you get from, are you from Jersey? I don't even know this stuff.
Am I from Jersey? Should I get up and leave now? Is that door unlocked?
You from?
I was born in a hospital in the Upper West Side of New York. I was put up for adoption the day I was born. And
how did they know?
How'd they know what?
That you were going to be a fucking pain in the ass to have you adopted. How did they know that?
I don't know. I thought everybody knew. I thought it came with the paperwork.
Because if I had the information I have today.
There's the door. I keep saying it.
but I meant something else. That's okay.
Oh, I missed it.
And then you were adopted by very, very good parents, right?
Yes. The Kramers adopted me on my second birthday. In those days, in the late 50s in New York City, you could have your child in foster homes right up till his or her second birthday. And then on that day, the mother needs to either say, yes, I'm in a position now where I can care for this child properly, or I want to put it up for adoption. And in the late 50s, healthy, allegedly Jewish babies, male babies in New York City, were a hot commodity. So I was signed off on and taken away on my second birthday, out to Long Island to Rosalind and Gary Kramer. My father was a car salesman at Robert Chevrolet in Hicksville. And my mom was a housemaker like so many other women in that era, you know.
And you were a skilled musician from an early age, right?
Yeah, I was the most insufferable thing on the planet for a while. I was a borderline child prodigy. Uh-huh. So I had
on the organ, right?
Yeah, on the classical organ.
Could you demonstrate again, please?
That's about what's left of my classical training.
But were you like John Cale and people like that giving concerts as you were young?
No, I was in competitions and things like that, and there was always someone who beat me, and it wasn't always the same person. For a few years, it was one guy who would get the red ribbon or the blue. Which one's bigger, the red ribbon or the blue ribbon? Which is first place?
Blue.
Ready? Do you know? Blue ribbon. Okay, I would always get the red ribbon or gold or pink or something like that. So I was never the best, and I always wanted to be the best because I was a child prodigy, and I was arrogant, and that arrogance carried through, as many people who know me in my early years with Shimmy Disc would tell you, and didn't really taper off until I had my daughter, in which case I found there were more important things than pretending I was God's gift to
me. And also you found out that you weren't good at something. That's what parenthood teaches you.
Well, yeah, I actually knew that from a very early age.
Now, do you remember the name of the guy who beat you at all the...
No.
I'd love to follow that person's career.
Find out where he is right now?
Get him on the phone.
You think he can do this?
He just spends all his time going, well, at least I beat Kramer.
There we go. I could do that too. Those are the days.
And then you went to some weird-ass music camp or something.
I went to a place called the Creative Music Studio, which was run by a gentleman named Dr. Carl Hans Berger. That sounds, God,
that's
you know.
That's a very, very Mel Brooks name.
He only died a couple of years ago, and he still has a very strong place in my heart. He taught me how to be a musician as opposed to how to play music. Mm-hmm. He taught me what being a musician was about.
And you don't live it, it won't come out the horn, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that you have to be present in the moment of musical creation, particularly in improvisation, which was what I was most interested in at the time.
Well, no one is more present. Having been on stage with you several places, the Knitting Factory and so on, you are very present. There's no idea what's going to pop into your head. I've always been envious of that, how you seem to be right there on stage when it's happening and not lost in your thoughts.
Wow. Okay. Now, slowly, can you tell me what I did? I'm listening.
Well, you seem to be listening, and you seem to be really right there. I was on stage with you with Jed Fair, I believe, and with Daniel Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I was also with Captain Howdy. We did a couple shows, right?
Yeah, and who did we get Tony Maimone to play bass, the bassist from Perubu? I can't remember who was playing bass there. I think I was playing, faking my way through some guitar parts or something. I can't remember.
And you got to say, for one show, you got to say a real, like, flash heavy metal drummer. That made me laugh on everything.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I remember.
He played without
his
shirt on.
And he had lots of drums,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he did not belong.
No, he didn't.
And you were not at the final rehearsal. You had some personal things to attend to.
You can talk about it. I remember that. You can tell people where I was.
You were in jail.
I was in jail. Yes, I was in jail. I wasn't there overnight, but I was in jail at the
time.
And
so I had to run the rehearsal.
Yeah.
Which,
how did that go?
You being in jail was not as startling as me having to run the rehearsal. So I went into the rehearsal, and you had found this drummer who you told me had too many drums and that we had to hold back.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So I didn't tell you I met him in a steam room.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did.
So he showed up, and he did not fit in with the sensibility of the band.
No.
And we were playing some sort of hoity-toity New York downtown type showcase.
Yeah.
And you had given me this drummer. So I was there. I was there with the bass player and someone else filling in. And I think I might have even had to play guitar for the rehearsal, do something. And I was also singing.
Were you about to say you think you played the guitar?
I think I did something.
I was better off in jail if that's actually what happened. Wow.
I had to do something. Uh-huh. And so the drummer, you had told me, make it very clear to him that he needs to be on a short leash for this.
Right.
So I thought, well, motherfucker's in jail.
Yeah.
What's he going to do? So I remember.
Take some initiative.
To the horror, absolute horror of everyone else in the band. I said to him after the first run-through, which was atrociously overplayed, I said to him, I think we need more from you. I think we need more. I want a lot of flash on the drums. I said, use those double basses.
And take your shirt off.
Yeah, he did take his shirt off. He didn't have to be told that. I said, give us a lot of the Quaalude Thunder. You know, which is what Frank Zappa called the double bass drums. And I said, really go around the kit, really use it. And we did another run through, and the other people in the band, who I don't remember.
Neither do I.
Were appalled and looked to me as their de facto leader to say, okay, that was a fine joke that time through, but certainly you'll tell him to hold back. And I said, perfect. And you were not able to, let's say, show up until the actual gig.
Right.
And you walked on stage and saw our sound check and saw his drums and thought, this is a fucking nightmare. Why does he have these drums set up? And then you said, did you run through the rehearsal? And I said, yes, I did, with a great deal of pride. And you were there with your guitar. And I don't even think we got a sound check, really. I think it was like one song on a,
yeah,
it was
five
like a
minutes.
Dick Clark thing.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think there was much of a sound check. So I remember on stage, and you counted it off, and it's just like, and it's like a Kiss drum solo from the very beginning. And I remember I didn't know which way it was going to go. I thought you might kill me. I mean, you had just gotten out of jail.
Yeah, I had other things on my mind.
And I remember you laughing through the entire song. And then going off stage, I don't forget what you said, but something to the effect of, what the fuck did you do, you asshole? I said, I just told the drummer to play out. And you said, you didn't actually tell him that. I said, yes, I did. And I think it was the happiest moment of that drummer's life. He was playing a downtown hip club. He was playing his little ass off with no shirt on, nothing.
It certainly would have been the happiest moment in that 24 hours of my life, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, that's a low bar.
Yeah.
That was a bad time for you.
Yeah, well, that's sweet.
Well, you know, a lot of bad times for people include I was in jail. That is always part of it.
Many of whom have been on this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Now, was this a real, artsy camp that you went to? A school? What was it? What did we call it?
It was called the Creative Music Studio. I'll tell you what happened the day I arrived there. The day I arrived here, all these musicians, I think they accepted 15 students per semester. And I'm shown to my room. I unpack some of my stuff. I look for ticks. You know, this was in the Woodstock Mountains. And I come out of my room and...
How'd you know to look for ticks? You're a New York City boy.
Long Island?
Oh, okay.
You kidding? I'm not a New York City boy. I grew up on Long Island.
With that drummer.
I rolled into New York City on the Long Island Railroad to see Led Zeppelin in 1973 and 74 when tickets were $2.75. And then in 75 when tickets went up to $3.25, there were riots at the Ticketmaster desk. Those are the days. What was I talking about just before that?
Were picking ticks.
Okay, so I'm picking ticks. I come out of my room. It's a beautiful day. It's a summer session. I yawn. I open my eyes. And who is walking across the lawn with an Alasa Apso by each side? Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Now, the oceans of Buddhists who listen to Penn Sunday School every Sunday will know exactly who I'm talking about. But for those two or three people who don't, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was the head of the Tibetan Buddhism sect, acknowledged in the world, and I think he was the reincarnation of, you know, one of those deity kind of thing. You know what I'm talking about? He was the guy.
Lloyd Bridges.
Yeah, right.
Lloyd Bridges is a Buddhist.
Just as big as Lloyd Bridges. And he's walking across the lawn, and I thought, what's he doing here at the music
school? You recognized him.
Oh, right away. I had been reading stuff. At the time, I was reading the woo-woo stuff. I wasn't woo-woo at all, but I was reading Tibetan text. I had read Kerouac, and I was into Ginsberg, and all of these guys were very, very focused on, on Buddhism. So I, of course, was as interested in that as I was in their art, and I read everything I could. You know, we were kids. We read everything. We tried to figure out what was bullshit and what wasn't. Sometimes it took longer than we wished to come to the final conclusion. But anyway, it turned out that this was a combination jazz and composer's school and Buddhist retreat. And Carl Berger was one of the big contributors to this. So this wasn't the only time that Rinpoche was there. Mm-hmm. And Rinpoche, you know, he had this public persona of being very godly and saying things that were very deep and would help you to go home and live the next year of your life until your next crisis came along, at which time you would have to consult your texts again. But in actuality, he tried to pick up every girl who was there and was drinking heavily. And eventually on one of those trips drove himself he was into driving fast also. He would borrow people's cars. So you'd see this guy who looked like the Buddha himself driving a Maserati really fast. And he eventually did get drunk and drive himself into a tree and was partially paralyzed for the rest of his life. He was a great character. He said wonderful, wonderful things, but he really did lead a very earthly life. You know, in his mind, his thoughts were lofty and approaching the bardos at every moment, but in reality, he was very much into being alive and having his feet on the ground and experiencing as much of the sensual pleasures as being alive would allow.
Well, if you have your feet on the ground with the Maserati, you break your ankles.
One would imagine.
If that you try to Fred Flintstone a Maserati, you're in trouble.
Yeah. So the next thing I discovered was that the corresponding diet at this jazz music school was completely vegan. That was the next shock. I was 18 years old.
And it kept you very healthy for your whole life.
It transformed me from being a partially sickly kid. I was always having colds and sinus infections and chest infections. And in those days, I don't know if you remember this, but in the 70s, they didn't know that antibiotics given to you once every 3 or 4 weeks would render them useless and pointless. And also that they were absolutely of no use against the common cold.
Right.
You know, so I was being fed antibiotics constantly. My doctor would say, you have a chest infection, you have a sinus infection, you have a bronchial infection, constant antibiotics. And I got to this school, and within 2 months, by the end of that first session, I didn't even realize it as it was happening. It was at the end of the session, I was driving home to Long Island, and I thought, wow, I haven't been sick in 10 weeks. This entire 10-week session, I hadn't been sick. So I thought, well, let's experiment with this, and I kept the diet going, and with exceptions for things like hot fudge sundaes and an occasional onion omelet, I've kept it going.
Yeah, but when you say, I mean, we don't want to get into, we talk too much diet on this show,
yeah.
But when you say occasional exceptions, mm-hmm. See, when I think occasional exceptions, I think, well, I have a hot fudge sundae every day.
Yeah.
But it's really like a biannual event for you.
Well, I'll have a sundae once a month.
Okay.
Nowadays, but the omelet once a year. I'm sort of clued into the damage eggs can do, particularly for women. It's they're directly, well, you listen to Gregor's podcast,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
They're directly connected to breast cancer, directly. There is no refuting it anymore. So I'm always telling women, you know, if you love eggs, please don't love them so much. Just once.
There's also a lot of good egg substitutes.
Yes, there are.
You know, if you want to go to McDonald's vegan, you know.
And some of them actually taste like eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I find the scrambled eggs with just eggs are really, really good. And when did you start? And then you went, what was your first, like, job as a musician?
My first job as a musician was with a Australian lunatic named David Allen and a band called Gong.
Oh, yes.
I was making these trips down to New York City.
I didn't know you played with Gong.
I played with New York Gong. This was before I knew you. I was Bill Laswell, Fred Marr, Michael Beinhorn, and I were...
You played with Magma?
I played with Yoshko Sefer
from Christ. Magma.
They wanted to bring Magma over for the whole tour, but the band as a whole was way too prescient to allow themselves to be brought over and put on a tour bus with David Allen, who had a bit of a reputation as a wild man. But as it turned out, David Allen showed up and he had just given up drugs. It wasn't smoking anymore and wasn't doing acid anymore. And this was something that he had been doing every day.
Allegedly.
For his entire adult life, you know, and he had just turned 40 and I had just turned 20. So we bonded over that. And the day I met him, he told me how he used to sell newspapers, copies of the New York Herald Tribune or the World Herald Tribune, I can't remember now, on the street corners in Paris with Terry Riley. So it was him and Terry Riley selling the Herald Tribune, and then they would go back to their apartment
just
at night.
Just for people who've gotten lost, this is a who's who of avant-garde music.
Yeah, this is how it started. And at night after they were done selling their papers, they would go back to their apartment and do tape manipulation experiments. Mm-hmm. So the whole tape loop thing started coming up around this time, and this is how David got into loops. And, you know, this was in the days when you would have a mic stand on one side of the room and a tape recorder on the other side of the room, and the tape would literally be going around the room,
right,
held up by the mic stand. And
which was the way it was done a lot.
Yeah, that's the way it was
you
done.
Know,
all the early Fluxus stuff.
You read about that and you say, this is one nut who set it up like that. Other people must have had a better way.
No.
But everybody you read about is doing the same thing.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. So I joined that. I was coming down into New York City and I met Giorgio Gomelsky at the Zoo Festival, and he took a shining to me and pointed his beard at me and said, David Allen is coming. We've got to hook you up with him. He's great. You go and play trombone in this band. And I said, trombone? I'm a terrible trombone player, first of all. And second of all, there are few instruments worse than the trombone. I can play keyboards. I actually have a mini Moog. Oh, great. You play trombone too. So David Allen comes to town. I meet him. He takes a shine to me. And we put the band together. And Bill Laswell had just come to New York City from Detroit and was living in the basement of Zoo Place on 24th Street, I think it was. And we put this band together.
You're playing trombone?
No, I was playing keyboards at the time, but he made me take a couple of trombone solos just to...
You played trombone?
Yeah.
With gong?
Yeah.
Kraber, how could you not lead with that? The first time I met you, why did you stick out your hand and say, my name is Kraber,
I'm a trombone player?
With gong. I played trombone with gong. That simple sentence would have destroyed me.
Would our relationship be different now?
It would be closer.
Huh. I can't imagine us being any closer, Penn. There we go.
And you, I want to say this because if we forget this at the end of the show, people will be annoyed, I think.
Say it.
You now have a lot of your music being reissued by Joyful Noise.
No.
Plus new stuff.
No, only new stuff.
Oh, really?
There's almost nothing being reissued. The only reissues on, I am not concerned with the past at all. And those things,
you're an artist, you don't look back.
Ooh, I'm an artist.
Well, I was quoting Dylan.
Well, everything that I've released on Shimmy Disc since 2020, when it all started up again, has been new music. And the only re-releases have been things produced by Hal Wilner, who we lost to COVID. And I've been remixing some of the things in partnership with Michael Minzer, the executive producer, who put together all of Hal's spoken word records.
So if you want to listen to old stuff by Kraber,
you got to go find it.
You're shit out of luck.
Yeah. Well, some of it's on Spotify, and you can hear the stuff. Mm-hmm. In terms of buying it, I don't know. I don't really care. I never did.
Yeah. But you can find stuff that you did with the half Japanese. Music to strip.
That's all streaming, and there's been beautiful reissues on vinyl. That stuff's beautiful. Yeah. And that actually led to a lot of things. I mean, the reason I was called by Galaxy 500 was because the drummer in the band loved the drum sound on Music to Strip By. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. I wonder what they sound like. And they came in the studio, and their songs were three chords. But what they did with three chords was pretty extraordinary. It reminded me of how ashamed I should be of having missed what was great about the Velvet Underground when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Do you remember my story of working in a Corvette's record store and I saw this record with a banana on it and I think, what the hell's going on here? I got to bring this home and listen to it. The next day I brought it back to the store and said to the store manager, there's some kind of mistake here. They put the wrong record in the sleeve, obviously. You know, there's some kind of mix up at the plant or something because this is awful. This sounds like a rehearsal that was recorded with one microphone. What's going on here? You know, and he listened to it and said, no, that's the Velvet Underground. And I tried the other couple of records, but at the time, you know, I was a classical musician winning awards and too many notes. And I didn't get it at the time. I was, my favorite band when I was growing up was King Crimson. And through King Crimson, I discovered Fripp and Eno. And then Eno took me away, and he kind of still has me, really. And most of what I do nowadays is so-called ambient music. I'm very, very much into things that happen slowly and meditatively and where the changes are almost imperceptible, but they really have meaning and touch your soul. How pretentious that was.
But you can, and I've got to say this, because when people ask me my favorite songs, you know, mm-hmm. I always, Brownsville Girl by Bob Dylan and Up to Me by Bob Dylan and mm-hmm. No Time to Think by Bob Dylan. And
do you know what I mean by Lee Michaels?
Yeah, no. Can we hear a little bit of You Know What I Mean by Lee?
You're going to sing it?
Woo!
Do you know what I mean? Thank you very much.
And then I always throw in there, 9 minus 7 is 2. As a matter of fact, if you want to make me cry very quickly, 9 minus 7 is 2 is really one of the most powerful songs I know.
Okay, what's the first line?
This drug was making my stomach.
This drug was making my stomach turn. That drug was making me dumb. I remember my dad working overtime, banging the opening drum. Everything made me feel far away, far enough even for you. I still remember my number, I think it was 9 minus 7 is 2.
It's just such a great song. One of the best moments of my life was when you were working for Randy, Amazing Randy. And we were doing the No God Band, where Reddy was there too.
We were in sound check.
We were in sound check, and you grabbed a guitar. It wasn't your guitar. It's never your guitar.
I do that.
And we were sitting, and you sang that. I think there were other people around, but you sang that pretty much for me. And
did I remember the first line?
No,
then?
You didn't.
Okay.
And you also didn't remember the order, but the little cueing from your buddy Penn.
Right, I remember.
You got through it. Yankee, it's time to go home. And that wonderful thing, this guitar solo is killing me. Can you do that verse?
This guitar solo is killing me. Why can't I just get it right? Probably 'cause I don't pay him enough, but I'll make him stay here all night. You know, that's really silly stuff. It's the song has... It comes from the heart, except for those couple of lines that you seem to love so much more than the other.
I do love them, and I'll tell you why I love them. Because the song has this ethereal feel, coupled with the honesty about your friend in a nut house in Paris, which gives you this real depth. And then you come out of the guitar solo, and you have hit this top level of emotion. And then... This guitar solo is killing me. The whole phrasing of that and the it's killing me is kind of an old-fashioned way of saying I'm having trouble with this. And all of a sudden, you go from this ethereal, worldly character to almost a craftsman trying to get something done. And all of a sudden, we go from your heart right into the studio with you. And it is very silly, and it's that silliness that makes the rest of it be able to be more profound. Because if that came in with a different verse, you would go, you might go, oh, give me a break. And you break it with that so the audience can go, oh, he was really being honest about the other stuff because he's really honest about this. Okay. And it's a really, really nice thing. Plus, it's after a break. So you don't feel like you've sullied that other thing sits there beautifully, and then you come in and just go, hee, hee, hee.
Yeah, there is an instrumental break. You know, your analyses, in all sincerity, there are times when you talk to me about my music that I leave the conversation having learned something about my music. And it helps me to get to the next thing. And I made a record a few years ago that I was always thinking, this record is, part of the reason this record is as good as I think maybe it is because of some of the discussions you and I have had about my songwriting in the past. And that friend of mine in the Nut House in Paris, I haven't actually spoken to him in 20 years. He was very, very dear to me and I miss him terribly and haven't spoken to him in a long time. I have a friend in a nut house in Paris, strapped to his bed all alone. Pack up your troubles and sail away, Yankee, it's time to go home.
Just beautiful. Just beautiful.
Yeah, I meant that.
So epigrammatical.
I meant that. Right.
What album is that on?
Oh, gosh. What was that called? The Secret of Comedy.
Secret of Comedy. Secret of Comedy. That record, The Secret of Comedy. And I don't, you know, it's always terrible when you talk to an artist about this is my favorite thing because we are all in a, you know, so I call myself an artist there. We're all in a sense.
I heard that.
We're all in a sense so worried. We always go, oh, you don't like the other stuff. Isn't that what you go? You go, I did some other stuff too, you know? And it goes all the way. I remember telling Sondheim, how much I liked Assassins. And I carried on about it, and then Sondheim said, I've done some other stuff too, you know. Of course, in my mind, he hadn't. It was just Assassins.
God, Secret of Comedy is 95?
Yeah, yeah.
I think. So that's 30 years ago, and you're still fucking talking about it.
I know. Well, the Secret of Comedy, all the way through that record, is it's so personal and so universal. Mm-hmm. And it is a record I just keep coming back to. It's one of those, you know, whatever the number is, several dozen records that you just don't ever get over.
I never listened.
Not one that you go back and go, uh-huh. Oh, yeah, that, but one that just lives with you all the time. I can't recommend enough The Secret of Comedy.
I never listened to it.
You don't listen to your own stuff.
No, but not too long ago, I listened to one I made just a couple of years ago called And the Wind Blew It All Away.
Oh, yeah.
Because things have changed so much since I made that. I made that when my daughter was going through some personal difficulties and she wasn't speaking to me. And I was just in a really bad state. And now she is one of the happiest people in the world. She's playing drums in Brooklyn and so wonderful. And so I listened to it and it reminds me of this point in my life that I got through.
You just slid over the part that's heartbreaking. She's a drummer. That's her problem. That's bad parenting.
Hey, she'll be the first to tell you that I tried my best to steer her away from this stuff. She went to film school, for God's sake.
Okay. But I want to talk just for a moment about Masterclass, which is lifelong learning. They have the greatest instructors. They have, what is it, like 88 instructors, and they have a zillion classes you can take. Fabulous, fabulous stuff. 11 categories, 180-plus instructors. For a very reasonable price, you get all of them. What have you been studying lately? Ready, Rich?
Frank Gehry.
Oh, really?
The architect.
He does. I know Frank, as opposed to Frank Gehry the Barbarian. And what did you learn from him?
He might be related to you.
Really?
So much like you. You have to watch this one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will. And what did you learn from that didn't have to do with architecture?
He talks about something that I've heard you talk about in a similar way, about writer's block.
Uh-huh.
He says it doesn't exist.
Right.
Just write.
Yeah.
Can I say something?
Sure.
There was a PBS program called Creativity in the Mind, and it was a roundtable discussion show moderated by a neuroscientist who was obsessed with artists. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an artist at all. He was a neuroscientist, but his entire point of focus was, where does that come from? How do they do this? And it was episode number one. And he said, here we are. This is the beginning. And I have to ask this question. This is the first question I've been dying to ask this. And he said, this is for anyone who wants to take it. Where does inspiration come from? And Chuck Close and Richard Serra were sitting next to each other. And Richard Serra rolls his eyes. Chuck Close could do little more at that point in his life than roll his eyes. And Richard Serra looks at Chuck Close and says, do you want to take this? And Chuck Close says, Richard and I went to Yale Art School together, and we had a saying there, inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. The great thing about Masterclass is we did the one on magic, because it's the best instructors mm-hmm. in the world. And they do a beautiful job. The production is gorgeous. The people really learn from you and then figure out how to pass it on to others. And it's amazing when you watch things that have nothing to do with anything. And there's a lot of stuff in this you care about. But don't ignore the ones you don't care about, because you can learn so much from someone who's talking about something you never intend to do, uh-huh. but just to see someone else's point of view on the world. And we've still been saying 11 categories and 180-plus instructors, but it's much more than that. And it's people like Steve Martin and Ron Howard and Amy Poehler. It's just, you know, Steve Martin teaching comedy, which Hondra was saying that he has watched 3 times now. He just keeps watching it over and over again. There's so much to learn. And it's on, I got to say this, but it's a waste of time. It's on every format, because you know it's on every format. Mm. And you can watch it in any order, and the chunks are great. And there's other sorts of supplementary material. But the amazing thing is, once you have a membership, you get everything. Mm-hmm. There's no other cost. We get a membership, you get everything. And right now, our listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/Ben. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/Ben. masterclass.com/Ben. Do you like that little Jerry Lee Lewis thing I do?
I love it.
Masterclass is not available on magnetic wire.
That's true. It's not.
So what is Steve Martin? Does he go into the philosophy of comedy?
Oh, yeah. Comedy? Oh, yeah. Well,
okay. I would be really interested.
Yeah, you would be.
Yeah.
There's a man who wrote The Secret of Comedy.
Yeah. Well, Steve Martin was engaged for a while to Bertrand Russell's daughter. So they were at the dinner table for long periods of time together.
Wow.
In his formative years. Yeah.
Well, his degree is in philosophy.
Yeah, right. But Bertrand Russell, that's kind of an Uber degree, isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of an Uber degree. You're kind of covered there.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
After playing trombone with Gong.
My God, what a segue.
You started Shimmy Disc, which was your record company.
That wasn't right after Gong.
But during that time, you played with the Fugs.
No, that was after that, too.
But I would talk about playing with the Fugs.
Should I? Let's go chronologically, because okay. I can go through this really quickly. Right after that, I was... I had met John Zorn at the Creative Music Studio, and we were doing a lot of improvised music gigs downtown. We played at a place called Studio Henry, which was six steps down into a basement, and you know those giant water beetles in New York. And nobody would come to those gigs. Occasionally, there were four people at the gig. Two of them would be John's parents, and one of them would be Paul Simon, just standing in the back with his back against the wall. He was there a lot.
That's the thing that I'm learning. Is that we all know, you know, that Frank Zappa, you know, loved the avant-garde musicians. You know, he really, really, the composer. What's the composer?
Perez.
But what I didn't know until recently is that Paul Simon was nuts for Perez.
Yeah.
And Paul Simon was in the avant-garde music. Also, Paul McCartney.
Yes.
Knew a lot of the avant-garde stuff.
Yep.
And we always think of John Lennon as being the avant-garde one, and that's just not true.
No.
It was Paul McCartney that was at that. But Paul Simon would have been at a John Zorn Kramer concert.
Yeah. Now, John Lennon's attachment to the avant-garde was directly to Yoko, and through that, I don't think he'd ever heard of Fluxus before he met Yoko.
And I also didn't know that Yoko sang with Lonely Woman.
Ornette Coleman.
Ornette Coleman. Yeah. You know she sang with Ornette Coleman?
Yeah. She got around.
She did. She did, and not in the Beach Boys way.
No. And then in 1981, I started playing in a country western LSD band. LSDCNW, he called it. It was run by Eugene Chadbourne.
And LSDCNW?
LSDCNW.
That's the name?
Yeah, that was the style of music. The group was called the Chadbournes, but we played LSDCNW. Uh-huh. So we're talking about speedcore versions of Hank Williams songs and touring through the Deep South and really pissing people off. One gig in particular, some guy comes up to us after the show and says, I don't think I like the way you took that solo in that Hank Williams tune. I think I'm going to go on home, get my shotgun, come back here and blow your fucking head off. And Eugene said, do you usually murder people whose guitar solos you don't like? And the guy spit on the ground, looked him in the eye and said, yep. Suffice to say, we packed up our gear expeditiously.
do you usually murder people whose guitar solos? Now, there was someone committed to music.
Yeah. Oh, he was turning heads. And that went
I met the guy who was going to come back and blow his head off.
Oh, he meant it.
That's a guy committed to music.
I even remember the name of the club. It was called The Chucker. Chukker.
Oh, my God.
And it was in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It's one of the many things from those tours I'll never forget. And then Tom Cora and John Zorn, the late, great Tom Cora and John Zorn, not long after that experience, departed the band, mm-hmm. seeing that a career with multiple similar instances might not be in their best interest.
John Zorn was in the
LSDC. He was in the Chadbourne.
LSDC.
Yeah, he was in the Chadbourne's. So they stayed home and we went out on the road as a trio and got very loud. And that became Shockabilly.
Oh, Shockabilly. I love Shockabilly.
Right. And then we made four records, a couple of them for Rough Trade. Did some work at Grog Kill with Mike Mantler. Had Ed Sanders come in and sing Nicaragua, which I co-wrote with him. And then Chadbourne and I had a falling out just as the Butthole Surfers needed a bass player.
Mm-hmm.
But we did skip over the 1984 Fugs. I had met Ed Sanders in Woodstock in the late 70s when I was going to the Creative Music Studio, and he kind of latched on to me, and I was writing a lot of stuff with him. I composed the music for his Karen Silkwood Cantata, among many other things, and helped him develop the music side of some instruments that he was creating, the Talking Tie, for example, mm-hmm. which is a kind of a keyboard on a tie, but he would sing poetry by Sappho and play music on the Talking Tie. Those were beautiful times. And I bugged him for years to put the Fugs back together, and he was not really into it at all. And then Reagan came along, and suddenly he felt there was a need for the Fugs again. And we played a couple gigs at the Bottom Line and did a tour of Europe. And I then did the most unprofessional thing I've ever done. I quit in the middle of that tour. And I regret it to this day, even though the reasons that I quit were totally valid. And there's no reason to get into that here.
Okay. Yeah. And you also, for those people who are really out in the far reaches of the avant-garde, you played with Gigi Allen.
Once,
okay.
Yeah. Is he the avant-garde?
I don't know what he is. Never mind. Forget I said that.
Okay. Did people want to know what his thing was? Do we want to tell the Sunday school?
If they know, they know. If they don't, they don't.
So you're telling them to Google that shit.
If they Google Gigi Allen, they can decide how much they want to click on.
Well, okay? let's make sure they don't miss it. It's two letters, G-G, and then Allen is spelled A-L-L-I-N. So, have a peek.
I believe you wore a poncho to that gig, is that right?
I did, and
disposable poncho.
That was that one gig was Gigi Allen and the Super Scum, and it was a super group, allegedly. Me on bass.
Oh, Jay, not the Scum.
Yeah, thank you. Jay Maskus on guitar.
Oh, Jay Maskus.
Jay Maskus was on guitar. Steve Shelley.
Another Western Massachusetts boy.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, the band was Western Massachusetts. He probably just went to college there.
Did he go to college?
Well, he was in the five college area. He was considered a UMass.
Doesn't mean he went to college.
That's right. That's right. Does not.
And there was another guitarist, Gerard Cosloy, who was the head of Matador. No, he was the head of Homestead Records at the time and is now the head of Matador, which is one of the greatest labels in the world. He was also playing the guitar. And we rehearsed 10 songs, knowing full well that the chances of us getting through the first minute of the first song were slim to none. And that's exactly what happened. We didn't get a minute into the set before things went awry. Yeah.
And you also work with Gwar, right?
I produced their first record and signed them to Shimmy Disc when no one would give them the time of day. Even though their music was borderline unlistenable, it was just comedy. And I was into comedy a bit at the time. But it was the spectacle of the group that really drove me nuts. I thought, there's absolutely nothing like this. The music is awful. The songs are awful. And they would be the first to admit this. And so I signed them and put out their first record. And that led to a record deal with Metal Blade, I think, which was Warner Brothers' weirdo metal label at the time. And they went on to do great things. But the man who thought it all up, Dave Brocky, the lead singer, succumbed to a heroin addiction quite some time ago, I think. Mm. So there are no original members left in Gwar right now.
And, they're still touring.
They are still touring, yes.
So they're like the Mills Brothers.
Yeah, or like the Beach Boys will be in a good 10 years or so. Yeah.
And then after that?
Well, then Shimmy Discs.
Jad Fair.
Then Shimmy Discs.
Half Japanese.
Yeah, I bought Noise New York so that I wouldn't die on the road with the Butthole Surfers in 1985, because that seemed to me to be where it was going. Fast. So I thought, if I buy a recording studio, I can do what I really want to do, which was produce records. When I was a kid, I would listen to records and see, George Martin, producer, what does that mean? And when I learned what that meant, I was intrigued, and that's what I kind of wanted to be. Mm. And then
You saw the George Martin name on the Flanders and Swann records?
I did. My father had those records. And then I knew about his work with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, mm-hmm. who was a constant obsession in my childhood. And then I saw the names, people like Bob Johnson on early Leonard Cohen records. Mm-hmm. Then I saw his name on Bob Dylan records. And it went on from there. And I just got really interested in that end of things. And then Tony Visconti, who I later met and became good friends with when we were neighbors in a town called Stony Point, New York. And our daughters were growing up together. And the producing thing was always just something that I thought, I want to make records. I was much more interested in being the man behind the curtain than the man on stage. Mm-hmm. That's how Shimmy Disc started, and it simply started by me putting out one record, and it sold, and the distributor wanted another box of them, so I made another 250 records, and those sold, and then I suddenly thought, well, let's put out another record, and 10 years later...
What was the first record?
It was called The 20th Anniversary of the Summer of Love, and Half Japanese had a song on it, and Fred Frith, and Laraji, and all the people I was working with in the studio. I basically just... took the best songs from my first 20 or 30 sessions as a studio owner and put them on that record. And it turned out to be a good compilation. And then I signed King Missile, and then Bongwater came along. And
well, that was Ann Magnuson, who you probably don't want to get into, so to speak. So there we go. That was Bongwater.
And then John Zorn put out his first Naked City record on Shimmy Disc, and that's when he decided that he was going to start his own label, and his label, Sadiq Records, now has, I think, 450 releases of the most eclectic music of the 20th and 21st century. Really the most eclectic. Absolutely amazing. And then Shimmy Disc, the shit hit the fan in the late 90s, and I called Arthur Penn when that all fell apart, and he said, well, it's time for you to come to the Actor's Studio, and he made me a permanent observer, much to the chagrin of people there who were trying to get in, like, through the back door and couldn't for years, and Arthur just walked me right in the front door, and people were, who are you? Who is this? What is he doing here? Does he have any experience in theater or
film? You wrote music for Arthur Penn.
I wrote music for his Broadway play, Fortune's Fool, with Alan Bates and Frank Langella. And then I wrote the music for a few of his 42nd Street Theater thing. The Actors Studio didn't want to have a theater. They felt that they were a actor's laboratory and that they should be working as a laboratory. It was a place where actors honed their craft, and that it was not a theater where people from the outside could come. They were very...
insular.
Yes, very, very much so. So Arthur, because he was the president of the studio at the time, said, well, fuck that. I'm just going to use my own money and build my own theater. And he built a little theater with 99 seats way west 42nd Street, because if it had 100 seats, I believe he'd have had to put in a wheelchair ramp. So he did.
There's other stuff,
too. Other stuff, too, right. But he kept the cost down and was able to do that. And we rehearsed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? For 6 months before putting it on. What a process he had. We would sit around a table for 2 weeks reading the play. And then he, out of the blue, without him warning anybody, he would say, okay, now close your books. And people would close the books and they'd look at him and say, okay, now let's do it. And they would start doing what they remembered of the reading. And Arthur would stop them right away and say, no, we're off book now. We're not doing the books. You are the characters.
I see.
And you are now going to be the characters from the play. And after a couple of weeks of that, and a couple of the actors left because they couldn't do it. So there were early replacements right away. And these were people from the Actor's Studio, so it wasn't difficult to replace the people who couldn't handle Arthur's process. Process being his favorite word. Do you remember that?
Yep.
What's your favorite word? Process. And he would go through weeks and weeks of this, and then we would pull away the table, and people would stand up and start moving around the room. Then we would move into the theater and start moving around the stage. And after 2 months of that, he would say, now we go back to the book. So for 2 months, the actors are improvising as George and Martha, mm-hmm. doing their thing, and the life that was infused into the text when we went back to the book was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. Not like I'd experienced a lot. My experience was in film. As you know, I watched 3 or 4 movies a day if I had nothing else to do. But I had no experience in theater, so I was seeing and experiencing things that were wholly new to me. And
for those of you who don't know the connection, Arthur Penn directed our movie Penn and Teller Get Killed.
And that's where I met him, in the laboratory next to the urinal.
Probably better known marginally for Little Big Man and Bonnie Clyde.
And if you go way back, my favorite film of his is 1958, the year I was born, The Left-Handed Gun, starring Paul Newman. See that movie if you want to see the true origins of violence in American cinema. That was something else. Things happened in that film that were unwatchable. And then he kind of progressed.
And Paul Newman, unbelievable in that. Or I should say believable in that.
It was the real thing. And for those of you who don't know The Left-Handed Gun, he was playing Billy the Kid. Mm-hmm. It was one of the early Billy the Kid movies, and it was extraordinary. Those icy blue eyes in black and white, staring at his best friend dying across the room from him, filled with bullet holes. There are incredible scenes in that movie, and that led him to The Miracle Worker, which is where Hollywood started to really take notice, and Patty Duke won the Oscar, and Anne Bancroft.
And he also, I talked a lot about, he directed Martin and Lewis.
That's
in
right.
In the 50s, yeah.
And more importantly, he directed Nichols and May.
He did, yes he did.
And I have a record, An Evening with Nichols and May, and right on the front it says, directed by Arthur Penn. Says it on the record. And then he did, they allowed him to do his dream project, which was Mickey One, which he later said was
a crazy movie.
Yeah, he said, they just let me do what I wanted to do, and that was a mistake at that point in my career, and it didn't work out.
And I will also say, Arthur Penn was always called Penn or Penny.
Right, Penny.
But also Penn, quite a bit. And so when we worked on Penn and Teller Get Killed, we made a rule that neither of us could be called Penn.
So what did you call him?
He was called Arthur, and I was called Mr. Gillette.
He called you Mr. Gillette? That's interesting.
No, only because we had to have a truce on the name Penn. Because we said during the first meetings, we can't be on set with someone yelling Penn and both of us turning around. We have to fix this. So that's how we fixed it.
Wow. And then in 1964, he did The Chase with Marlon Brando, which has extraordinary performances by people like the drunk actor with a beautiful name who crashed into a bank in Connecticut where he lived when he was shit drunk. What was his name? My God.
Well, we will leave it there.
We'll leave that
as the quiz section here.
Yes.
But if you want to hear the
Rip Torn.
Rip Torn, yes. If you want to hear the new stuff that Kramer's doing, A Joyful Noise. Is that the name of the website?
No, it's shimmydisc.com. Carl Hofstetter at Joyful Noise made me the artist in residence there in 2020. And when my 5 record set was completed and on its way out, he said, so what's going on with Shimmy Disc? And I said, well, nothing. And he said, do you own the logo? And I said, yes, I do, actually. And he said, well, then let's restart the label. Long silence. And I said, let me talk to my wife about that. And Valerie and I talked about it for a while. And the next day I called Carl and I said, if I can be the head of A&R, if I can choose the artists and make the records and do absolutely nothing else, I can do this. And he said, oh, we can handle everything else for you. And he has. And those are the two words that define the reemergence of Shimmy Disc, Carl Hofstetter. And his label is called Joyful Noise, which is one of the greatest independent labels in the country.
It really is. Something but us one.
It really is great, with artists like Kishibashi and Deerhoof and so many, too numerous to mention. Just fantastic label. Everything on the label is just great. And I'm up to my 25th release now, and keep it going as long as I can. Financially, it's not terribly tenable, but...
Well, you're staying at my house, so you know that I'm in the office in the morning. You know what I'm listening to.
You're listening to me a lot.
Yeah, I do that.
Can I tell people about the Church of Noise?
Yeah, please.
One of the greatest things Carl Hofstetter has done is form a nonprofit called the Church of Noise. Donations made to the Church of Noise go toward recording projects for artists who are impoverished or in places where there are no recording studios all over the world. People apply for a grant from the Church of Noise, and there is a church of elders at the church, and they listen to the music, and each elder gets to pick one artist per year that they send several thousand dollars to, and that facilitates the recording and production and mixing and mastering of music, very often the first music that these musicians are making. So it's really, really, really a great cause. And it's 100% tax deductible. And
Church of Noise.
The Church of Noise.
And
just Google it.
A search of the Church of Noise will get you.
I think it's churchofnoise.com.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
And it's really, really important. And a lot of people have given. Anyway, if you'd like to be one of those people, it would be greatly appreciated by artists you will never meet who are making outstanding music under the radar that is not bound to sell a lot of copies, but it will extend the creative lives of the artists that you're donating to. It's a great cause.
Well, that was Penn Sunday School brought to you by MasterClass. Right now, you can get additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/Penn. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/Penn. masterclass.com/Penn. And you know something? You know something? That was Penn Sunday School.
That was Penn Sunday School.
Cha cha cha.
And to our listening,
you become naked. Thank you, Kramer. This is a blast. There's stuff I didn't even know.
Uh-huh.
That was Penn Sunday School. Trombone with gong. That was Penn Sunday School. Hey, Matt Donnelly, you got anybody you want to thank?
Nick Dingman, Colin Durham, Susie Felber, Lancey Minshew, Harlan Liam Clark, Michelle Yeiser, Rogan Hastings, Placida Scott, Damian Martin, Garth Reynolds, Adam Luce read random and he loved it, Timo Tehoff, Mark Pickenheim, Terry, Scott Kelly, Kirk Barrett, Adam Berzins, Carlos Alvarez, Michael Cornwall, Rob Aligar, Ross Devereaux, Ryan Matthews, Jeff Bacher, Michael Torbay, Ilan Lee, Jeff Loomis, Jacob McCauley, Impetuous Man, Nicole Martin, Music Man, Keith Corning, off the record, no thank you, Daddy. Rachel Hawkins, Jake Schneider, Pete Hoke, Kelly McCauley, Corey Mitchell, Robin Garnett, UpturnCoach.com, TurnUpTheProfit.YourBudget, love Julie Lynn and Tom. Obi Demetrian Jr., Jeremy R. 22, Winter Ryakowski, Kristen Kladick, Hadi Wambi, Michael Cohen, Quiet Numbskulls, I'm broadcasting. Dr. Scooplittle, Jeremiah Jenkins, Piff the Magic Dragon, buy the book at piffthemagicdragon.com. Alexander Hoffman, I'm going to switch the page here. Danny Olwine, Stephen Volcano, Jim the Magician Who, you know, Scoop the Mids, and Paul McBride. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.